Hello and welcome to The Confident Mother. This is the online conference for ambitious women about confidently balancing work and life. So for me, the confidence in how you balance your work and life is based on five core elements. Contribution, which is about who you are and what you are, your wellness, your work, your family, and the feminine. So today's interview is going to be a little bit different. I'm going to be talking to Emily Jacob in just a couple of moments, and she's the founder of Reconnected Life. So I'll come on to tell you a bit more about Emily in just a moment. So I'm your host and founder. My name is Sherry Bevan. I'm the former global head of IT service for a city law firm, and now I help ambitious women get career confident. I've been running my own business as a coach and speaker since 2012, and very much based in the city for the clients that I work with, but also, as you can see there, that other photograph that you might not recognise is Chicago, and I spent a lot of time based in Chicago and commuting back and forth, which when I say that now sounds absolute madness, but just the way that my career worked out. So if today is the first interview that you're listening to, then very much a very warm welcome to you. When you register, you get a workbook, and I really do encourage you to take time and space to work your way through the questions in that workbook. They're designed to get you thinking, to get you pondering, and to get you asking yourself questions about what's most important to you in your life right now and what you want to be most important. All of the interviews today is no exception. We're all available on catch up for 48 hours after they've been broadcast. And if you go to theconfidentmother.co.uk, and if you go to the resources tab and then go to the Confident Mother 2017, and you'll see all the interviews there. Once they've been available for 48 hours, they get moved over to the box set. And if you want to grab a copy of the box set to have permanent access to all the interviews, you can get a copy of that there as well. And then finally, the prize draw for career confidence. So when you register, you're automatically entered into the prize draw to win a place on my six-week course, which starts in February. And this is for you if you'd love to get confident that your career is right for you. If you want to get clear on your career goals and you want to know how you're going to achieve them, or you simply just need to get more balance in your work and life, then that's what career confidence is for. So if you can go right ahead and book your place now, and there is a discount running throughout the conference as well. So today then, I'm going to be talking to Emily Jacob, who is the founder of Reconnected Life, and we're going to be talking about how to live a reconnected life and help others do it too. Now, Emily helps women who've been raped to go from surviving, coping one day at a time, living a half life, to living a full and whole connected life. She's a coach, she's a master NLP practitioner, and she really uses her skills, her knowledge, and her experience, and she's pioneering a whole body, mind, soul approach to recovery after rape. And what I love about Emily, she's got this really strong and powerful vision to end rape culture within a generation by empowering the rest of society to stand up for survivors. So this is a little bit different from my other interviews, but I'm just so in love with what Emily's doing and the work that she's doing. And it's such an important topic that it's one I couldn't miss out. So Emily, welcome. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hi, Sherry. Thank you for having me.
So I guess let's start off with Reconnected Life. So tell us a bit more about what that is and what you do and how you help these women.
Yeah, so I guess it comes from what I discovered through my own recovery, that we get a lot of help with symptoms and symptom management. But once we've had that help, I still didn't know how to be in the world, what the world was, who I was. I still felt really very fragile and broken. And as I was coincidentally learning how to be a coach and an NLP practitioner, I was finding that what I was learning was actually also helping me in my recovery.
Right.
So I started to put together a program which really has all the, what I think are the three key elements for how we can start to live reconnected, which is when we can manage our symptoms and feel that we can rescue ourselves, when we can figure out who we are and what we want to be, and that we don't need to cling on to ideas of being fragile anymore. And also when we can reconnect into our bodies, because that's the thing that we disassociated. Mm. And connecting into our bodies is something that's so, so important to feel like we are whole again. And then being able to just reconnect into the world as well, which is hence the name of my business, Reconnected Life, because that's really the outcome that we all deserve and that we can have.
So from what I'm understanding then, is kind of traditional rape recovery, if I can use that word, focuses on helping you to deal with the symptoms of how you're feeling, and what you're doing is allowing a woman to kind of really reconnect her body, her mind, her soul, and to go on to live a better, a more fuller life again.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's why what's currently available is called crisis, rape crisis. They're able to help with the immediate symptoms. Mm-hmm. But funding being what it is in this country means that's forever being under threat and reduced, and so that even for crisis management there's quite a lot long waiting lists, and often the time available that you can get that help is limited, which is why actually I think I'm getting such support from organisations like SARSAS in Bristol and RSVP in Birmingham, because what I'm doing is filling a gap in the how we help survivors live full lives after the immediate crisis.
Absolutely. And I think it's interesting that what you discovered as you were training to be a coach, that those skills and techniques were actually helping you to properly recover from your own experience.
And I think it's actually now I'm kind of looking back at it, it's no surprise, because coaching is very empowering. Mm-hmm. And that's actually what we need as survivors. We need to feel empowered. We need to feel more confident and more in control of ourselves and who we are and our place in the world. It's very easy, when you're still in that, call it kind of a dip of recovery and sort of clambering up and sliding back down to feel very put upon, to feel very broken and fragile and temporary. Mm-hmm. And coaching really helps to build that ability to rely on yourself a lot more, and to create the self that you want to be.
Mm. When we talked before, I mean, this interview doesn't kind of fit into the normal interview that I do. But one of the reasons I really wanted to get you involved is because the statistics on rape and the fact that we probably all know somebody who has had that experience or sexual violence, and yet we might be unaware of that. So can you perhaps just give us a bit more information about what is the incidence of rape?
So in this country, in England and Wales, it's estimated that there are 85,000 rapes of women a year and 12,000 of men. That means that every 6 minutes, one woman will be raped. It's a conservative estimate to say about one in every six women is raped in her lifetime. In fact, the World Health Organization uses one in three worldwide, and that excludes rape as a weapon of war. That is rape in the context of the way we would think about it in this country. And Rape Crisis says that one in five women have been raped or sexually assaulted in this country. So it's incredibly widespread. And sometimes when we can say we don't know anyone, I felt before it happened to me that rape was incredibly rare, because the only times I tended to know about it was when somebody had been apparently falsely accused, or if it was a very famous case. Mm. But I felt that it was a very rare thing, because I didn't think I knew anybody. When it happened to me and I started to disclose, I found out that actually it had happened already to a number of my friends and people in my circle. And it is so incredibly common. Just the other week, I was at a conference and there were six of us sitting around a table. And I knew that three of us had been raped. So that was already 50% of the people around the table. But because of what I do, the conversation had, you know, moved to these statistics. And the other three ladies also disclosed that it happened to them.
Oh, wow.
So it is it's incredibly common. It is what I call an epidemic. But I think this epidemic has been going on for a very long time and we just haven't uncovered it and unearthed it because we've not been talking about it. It's something that we stay very silent about. It's almost a stigma and a taboo about talking about rape. And so that's why it's part of my mission to talk about it.
Yes.
And to raise awareness.
Yeah. I mean, those figures are absolutely staggering. And to think that this conference that you mentioned there, that everybody at that table that you happened to be sat at had all experienced rape, just seems amazing. And it makes you wonder, like, you know, when I was at an event last week, you know, how many of those women that I was sat next to on the same table, how many of those had this experience? So I mean, it almost seems silly to say why don't we talk about this more, but I'm going to ask it anyway. So why don't we talk about this more?
Well, often when we do try to talk about it, we're often disbelieved. Right. We're often, if we are believed, then blamed and asked, could you not have done something about it? Mm. So we feel judged. So when I first started disclosing, I probably lost about 50% of my friends.
Wow.
Because they either didn't believe me, or felt that I could have behaved in a different way and therefore kept myself safe and therefore I deserved it and I just couldn't be around them. Mm. So that kind of judgment and blame, does make us feel very, very ashamed. And actually a lot of people will not even ever disclose. About 29% of women never disclose to friends or family at all. And I think that's because there is this overwhelming stigma about rape, that you were stupid, you couldn't protect yourself, you put yourself at risk. And we feel that even when people don't say it. So it's safer often not to disclose.
Yes, and that makes sense. Because you see so much, you know, when rapes do go to court, that very often the woman's sexual life or her behaviour or how she's behaved in the past is kind of brought into the evidence, when in fact rape is rape.
Yeah, rape is the only crime where you have to prove the crime has actually been committed at the same time as proving that the alleged perpetrator is the person who did it.
Yes, that's an interesting point. I hadn't thought about it that way. Yeah.
But yeah, it's only 15% of those 85,000 are reported to the police each year. Wow. And of those, only about 40% are even go to prosecution. So by the time somebody is being prosecuted for rape, you know, the CPS is pretty certain they did it. Mm-hmm. And yet the conviction rates are still quite low in comparison to other crimes.
Yeah, definitely. And we have the types of rape cases that make the media, the rapes that where, you know, the woman got grabbed in a dark alley or she was walking back through a park. Is that a typical scenario for rape, or is it a different type of scenario?
No, stranger rapes are only around, depending on which sources you look at, only around 10 to 20% of rapes. And in fact, that is growing because rapes that occur through online dating are characterized as stranger rapes, and those are growing and have been identified as a new category actually that needs to be tracked. But yeah, the majority of rapes are by somebody that you know. Mm-hmm. They happen in places that are supposed to be safe.
And I suppose the fact that it's somebody you know perhaps makes it harder to disclose and to seek help.
Absolutely. If you're being abused, attacked by a member of your family, or a family friend or a colleague, there are a whole range of other emotions that are happening as well as the fact that the rape has happened. And if it's a colleague, you may be fearing for your job. If it's a member of your family, you may love them, and they may have abused that love and betrayed that love, but you still have those feelings as well as the pain of what's happened. So there's a whole host of reasons why when it is somebody that you know, that it's harder to disclose and to talk about it and to report.
I guess it's something that, you know, for all of us, you know, if the rape statistics are that high, then we probably all know a family where it's happened, perhaps within the family, and obviously we don't know that that's what is happening. If a friend of mine said to me one day, I've been raped, or, whether it's a stranger rape or whether it's a friend or a family member, as a friend, what can I do to help or to support that woman?
The first thing you must do is make absolutely clear that you believe her.
Right.
Don't ask questions like, are you sure? Could you be mistaken? There's a thing that people said to me. But absolutely 100% believe her. And the next thing is to listen. Asking questions and asking for detail and specifics is not advised. You might want to know more details about maybe who it was, how it happened, how long ago. You might want to know the answers to those questions, but let her tell you in her own time, because what the asking of the questions can do is, first of all, it can almost make it seem that you might not believe until you get the answers to the question. So it kind of reduces her belief in your belief, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But also it can be re-traumatizing, especially if it's something that's just recently happened. Mm-hmm. To be asked to remember details that are at the time not wanting to be on the surface is actually very re-traumatizing. It's actually another reason why when women do report, it's very rarely immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Because actually the brain can't cope with all of the detail all at once.
So the brain is trying to protect you by submerging or pushing it backwards.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's one of the myths that it really needs to be kind of overcome, because that, you know, in the justice system, there's a kind of like, well, if you waited to report, maybe it did, you know, why did you wait? Well, surely you would have gone straight away.
Mm-hmm.
And often with stranger rapes, that's more likely to be the case, because it's more likely to have been more violent, and you know, you're more likely to have been believed.
Yeah.
But when it happens with somebody who you previously trusted, your brain is trying to figure out what's happening. Your brain is trying to convince yourself that actually it didn't happen as well, and hiding parts. So when you have to talk about it, it can be really, really re-traumatizing, bringing everything back to the surface and overwhelming.
And I guess as well, if it's somebody you know, you're probably questioning yourself, I'm guessing, how did I allow that to happen, or how did that happen, or did I misplace my trust and just question your own judgment, I'm guessing.
Oh, absolutely. And all the you know, the reasons why women don't disclose to other people are with ourselves as well. We also are, you know, questioning, well, was I to blame? Was I, could I have done something differently? It's my fault. I can't get him into trouble for something that I must have done to make him do that.
Yeah, and I guess in society as well, women are so often judged based on what they wear and what makeup they have, and whether they're walking out late at night or and all that kind of stuff. And so I suppose all of that judgment that you've heard about, seen about in the papers, on the radio, kind of all comes in as well. And I can imagine it can be pretty overwhelming.
It is, absolutely, yeah. And of course, all of that is absolutely false, because you can be raped in your jogging trousers without having had a shower for days in your own house by that uncle that you thought was always quite nice.
Yeah, yeah. So if a friend does report a rape to you, so first, you know, make absolutely clear that you believe us, and not to ask questions, which, you know, natural human curiosity, you kind of want to know the detail, but that's serving your curiosity, not serving her, and to listen and let her tell the story in her own time.
Yeah.
Would you then suggest that we should encourage her to report the rape officially, you know, to the police or whoever?
No.
Okay. Nice, clear answer.
I think that reporting is an incredibly personal choice. Mm-hmm. I think it's important for survivors to feel that they can make that choice for themselves.
Yeah.
I've got on my website, actually, I've got a long video about what you can do if a friend discloses. Mm. And I've also got another video which talks about whether or not to report to the police. And the thing is, as I said, talking about the specifics can be re-traumatizing. So reporting is by in its nature before anything's happened in terms of whether or not it's taken up by the CPS and goes to court.
Yeah.
It's an incredibly traumatizing experience just to give that witness statement.
Yes, I can imagine.
And I think that for a lot of people, they know that that's just going to be too much for them. A number of people want to do it anyway. A number of people know that, you know, when they report that, it's likely that they won't get justice, but they want to do it anyway, and they find that empowering.
Yeah.
But I think it's really important before you report to understand what the different outcomes might be, and to be to know that you'll be okay with those different outcomes.
Right.
And to look in, you know, to think about it. For me, I once lost a very good best friend because I said that I could never. Having reported, I could never encourage another woman to report. And she said, well, then you'd absolutely deserved it.
And
I'm no longer a best friend, but, I think that, I mean, from a justice perspective and from these men must be, you know, locked up, they must be punished. I totally agree, but it's incredibly difficult process to do, and I would never suggest that somebody has to do it. I would want that person to be fully informed of what it might involve and what the different outcomes could be, and to be supported through that process if they chose to do it.
So if a friend has, you know, told us that she's been raped, so no to encouraging her to report it, what could we suggest her to do, or is it just a matter of saying what do you want, what do you need?
It really is as simple as being there for what she needs. Mm. And sometimes that's she doesn't want to talk to anyone, but to have you come over and make her dinner while she sits and watches TV on the sofa, that, you know, simple as that. Helping, you know, when she's ready, helping to point her in the direction of resources which can help her make her decisions and choices about what she wants to do next, is something that you can do, but not in a way that would suggest that you expect her to do those things. Does that make sense?
Yes, yeah. And when women do disclose, do they tend to disclose, is it something they've been thinking about for weeks and weeks and weeks and suddenly it will all burst out? Or is it something that perhaps it might just slip out in a conversation when you're talking about something completely different? I mean...
Well, there are like however many billion people on the planet, I think everybody will disclose in a different way. Mm-hmm. I remember for some people, some of my friends, I did think, you know, when I told my brother, it was actually several years later and felt that I needed to tell him. And that was, I worked myself up into quite a tizz before managing that. Mm-hmm. That was definitely planned. But when I decided that I needed to move house because I'd tried to stay there, it happened in the place I'd been living in, mm-hmm. And I needed to move. And I went into the rental agencies, the tenants agency, and said, I'd like to get out of my contract early. I'd like to move. And they said, oh, why? I said, oh, because I was raped there. And they just kind of blurted out. I hadn't planned to tell him. But it was the answer to the question. So there's, you know, even in my own experience, there's the blurts and then there's the really kind of getting wound up.
Because it probably wasn't the answer that the agency were
expecting. No, bless him. He was quite a young man as well. I think he was quite new to the job.
I hope you didn't put him off for life.
I hope not.
So that all sounds fairly straightforward. It's just a matter of being a good friend to women who do disclose, you know, being there, listening, perhaps, you know, is it worth us going and finding out how to, you know, where to go? I mean, how can we signpost women to the right places?
So, Rape Crisis, Survivors Trust, they have a lot of resources on their websites. On my website, on Reconnected Life, I have a list of resources directing people to Rape Crisis, Survivors Trust, to SARCS, which you can get help if you want, where you can get help if you are thinking about reporting as well. ISVAs will support you throughout you help you decide if you want to report and support you through that process.
What was that you just mentioned?
ISVAs, you're going to ask me what it stands for, and I think it's Independent Sexual Violence Advisor, but okay, I'm wrong off the top of my head.
You're right, I was going to ask.
But they are independent to their name, but mm-hmm. they help support and advise you on the reporting process.
Right.
And are there as an independent objective friend, really.
And I imagine that can be really powerful, because I would think that your own friends, your own family, I mean, obviously nowhere near the way that you're traumatised, but for them as well, it's going to be a big shock and perhaps something not so easy to deal with, whereas an independent advisor is going to be able to be more objective.
Yeah, and to give you that advice, because they know how the justice system works.
Yeah.
So I can share in the Confident Mother group, if you like, the links that I have where all these resources are.
Fantastic. So I know you've talked about, you know, the importance of survivors needing to feel empowered. And one of the things you've talked about, the vision you have to end rape culture, and that is about empowering the rest of society. So I guess the first question is, you know, what do you mean by rape culture?
So this is interesting, because I'm actually writing a series for Psychology's magazine on their Life Labs platform, talking about this. So Wikipedia defines rape culture as a culture or a society where rape is pervasive. And I think from the statistics that we've talked about already, we can agree that rape is pervasive, however we want to define pervasive. I think that it's happening a lot. And then there are the things which kind of contribute to that. Now, you need to look at why rapists rape. And these are, you know, there's generally three groups of people who rape. There are those who know that they're doing something wrong, right, and they want to get away with it. Right. So these are the people who choose vulnerable women, you know, younger women, maybe, you know, children, and make it seem that this is okay and this is normal to, or it's all in their heads, and, you know, so they kind of create an environment and that where the victim is going to be very dissuaded from ever going to report and ever disclosing to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when this group of rapists understand that the victims will will know that what is happening is wrong,
yeah,
and will report, this group of rapists, because they don't want to get caught, won't do it anymore. Right. They will channel their need to do something wrong and get away with it into something else. Don't know
with
what that is.
But with someone else, perhaps.
Pardon?
Or with someone else, perhaps.
Or yeah, they don't want to get caught. They know that they might well get caught because society is changing and people will be talking about it.
Okay.
Then they will have to do something different and not. The second group of main group of rapists are those that actually think that what they're doing is normal. They can't identify with the idea of what they're doing being wrong. They think that the rapist is the monster who is hiding in the alleyway, and they know that they're not hiding in the alleyway, so they think that what they're doing is absolutely fine and normal. This is the rapist who thinks that the misogynistic banter, locker room talk, or whatever we want to call it, is actually the way everybody is.
Right.
So they think that what they're doing is normal.
Right.
And they also convince themselves that the victim really was asking for it and really did want it.
And presumably, therefore, I guess that's a difficult group to deal with, because they think that this is normal and it's okay, then perhaps fewer signs of remorse, and therefore people are less likely to believe the victim because they're so convinced it wasn't rape.
Absolutely. This is where you get the rapist who absolutely fundamentally denies it all the way through, even past conviction and jail time.
But they just don't see it as something wrong.
He doesn't believe that he's been at fault.
Mm.
But this is the group that, if we start to challenge that locker room talk, we start to say, actually, no, that's not right. We start to say, why are children, you know, why are women's bodies being objectified in that way? We start to challenge and pick holes in this, his belief that what he's doing is normal.
Mm-hmm.
Then we can actually make him realize that what he's doing is rape. And then he would want to stop because his sense of self cannot cope with the idea that he is that monster. So we have to educate him in terms of what is rape and what isn't.
Right.
And then the third type of rapist really is the psychopath. But then again, they don't want to get caught either. My vision really is that, because rape is a choice. It's not like we're trying to cure AIDS. It's not like we're trying to cure cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Rape could stop tomorrow, right now, if everybody decided not to rape.
Right.
So what we have to do is create a culture where to rape somebody is as taboo as to have somebody in slavery. And we, you know, slavery, yes, it still happens in the world, but we recognize that it's from the Dark Ages and it shouldn't be happening. That's where we need to put rape.
Yeah, and that I really like that analogy, and that makes absolute total sense to me, and actually that makes it seem more achievable, this vision you have to create a society where rape culture is gone.
However, that is quite a big vision. So, and now I'm going to ask you probably the $24 million question. You know, so how do we get rid of that rape culture? How do we change it?
I think it's just about every single one of us, whenever we see something that we think, hang on, that's not quite right, challenge it. So if it's as simple as doing something like, well, why is this t-shirt for boys in the store, why is it saying that he can be a hero and this other t-shirt for girls only saying that she should, you know, have ambition to be a housewife? As we still see these totally strange and 1950s led type of modeling in children's clothing, in children's toys. This stuff starts really young. Mm-hmm. We need to, it be empowering girls to believe they can be anything. We need to be empowering girls to know that their body is their own. That when the boy runs after her in the playground, that is not a good thing because it shows that he likes her, but actually he shouldn't be doing that. And she can tell him that she doesn't want him to do that. Mm. When we have daughters and they don't want to kiss grandma, we should be saying, actually, that's okay. Your body is your own, and you will only ever need to kiss those people that you want to kiss in your life.
You should, I think that's often obligated. Something, I mean, I've always felt very strongly, if my girls don't want to kiss the uncle or the aunt or the grandma or the granddad as they're leaving, that's their choice. It's their body. And if they don't want to kiss, fair enough.
Absolutely.
But I do know that I've seen, sometimes people will feel, oh no, give me a kiss, or let me have a kiss, or it's not fair if you don't give granny a kiss, or, things like, I mean, my family have never been anything like that, but it kind of is sending mixed messages, isn't it? That no, unless it's somebody you know, and that just doesn't make sense.
Especially as it's often someone that you know.
Yeah. The irony there.
The irony, exactly. And it's when, when there's somebody makes a sort of a misogynistic comment or some kind of joke that puts women down, feeling empowered to say, actually, what is so? Can you tell me what you find funny about that?
Hmm.
So, you don't need to say, you're a terrible person for finding that funny, but you can challenge the person and say, actually, what is it that you find funny? I'm interested. And just kind of pick the whole that way, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does. And I know, I pick up on things on the news or on the radio or in the media, and I'll say to my husband, oh my goodness, he shouldn't have said that. And he'll say, what is it you're seeing? Because he doesn't have such a highly tuned sense of awareness yet. And I guess that's what we all have a responsibility, don't we, to raise up the awareness of each and every one of us.
Yeah, it's kind of as simple as, until you start looking out for the yellow car on the road, you don't see the yellow car on the road.
Yes.
But once you're starting looking for it, you see it everywhere.
Yeah.
And that's actually the case with this, with rape culture. You start to see it everywhere when you're more aware that it's there. And that starts to, it can start initially, it can feel quite overwhelming. I was talking to a friend about this at coffee the other day, and she was saying, just because I'm hanging out with you and I'm reading some of the things you're writing, I'm starting to become more aware of this. Mm. And it's making me really angry. I was like, yes. Okay. Try to be aware without getting too angry. Instead, try to channel that anger into something more positive, because when we shout at people about this, they only hear us shouting because they haven't seen it yet. Mm. They think we're just being shrill.
Yes. And that's the difficult balance sometimes to get.
It is.
When you see things and when you have that heightened awareness, I shout but at the telly, but when I talk to other people, I moderate my shoutiness. And
yeah.
But, you know, but I do encourage my husband, if he ever heard, I mean, he's never been in with a group of men who some of the locker room banter that has been reported on the TV over the, you know, during, over the last 3 or 4 months, he's never heard any of that. But I keep saying to him, but if you did, you would call it, wouldn't you? You would say something. And I think that's what we all as individuals can do is to call it when we see it.
We have to acknowledge as well, though, of course, Sherry, that takes a great deal of bravery and courage. Oh, yeah. Because we, as humans, we've kind of been conditioned to go along with the flow, mm-hmm. you know, not to be the odd one out, not to be the one that says, hang on, that's not quite right. And so when you are that person, it does feel quite vulnerable. Mm. And so I understand entirely why people find it hard, but I'd challenge everyone listening to see if they can try it once. And then once they've done it once, it's much easier to do it a second time and a third time and a fourth time. My advice is don't do it in a large room with a microphone, which is what I've done in the past, and suddenly you feel very, very vulnerable.
Yeah, and I guess it comes back to that starfish thing, isn't it? We can't rescue all the starfishes that are washed up on the shore, but if we could all just rescue one starfish, then that would make a hell of a difference.
Well, absolutely. To end rape culture, it takes every single one of us at the grassroots level showing leadership in how we want the world to be. Mm. So when we see something that we think is not demonstrable of the world we want to live in, calling it out.
Mm. And how do you feel things have changed over the past sort of 5, 10, 15 years? Are we making progress?
I think we are. A number of people say to me, I think it's getting worse. Mm. I really think it's getting worse. And you know why I think they think it's getting worse? Because people are starting to talk about it.
Yes.
And I think that it's actually because people are starting to talk about it that it will get better. Because rape is something that exists in the shadows and in the darkness. Mm. It thrives on that. That's why, you know, people do it, because they won't get found out about it. When we're starting to talk about it, we're starting to, other survivors are starting to find their voices too. Mm. So we're starting to see more and more people talk about it. The fact that we are talking about it means that it's coming out of the darkness and out of the shadows. And that, I think, will mean that we can end it.
And that happens every time a high profile case comes to the fore, a well-known person, either as the perpetrator or the victim, that you suddenly see a flurry of people saying, yes, that was me too. So I think the more we can talk about it, and the more that comes out about some of the cases in recent years of how that sort of behaviour was more acceptable, or people turned a blind eye, you know, women just weren't believed. So I think, I'd like to think that it is changing. And I guess the reason it feels like things aren't is because people are talking about it more.
Yeah, exactly. And I think we're at a real tipping point. I think that we are going to start to get more convictions. I think we're going to start to have more people come forward. And I think we are going to start to be able to eradicate rape culture. I have to believe that, otherwise I see no hope for the world. So I'm kind of clinging on to my utopian nirvana. Of there being no rape anymore.
And I think I remember reading a long time ago that in the past, I'm not saying that still now in the present, but from what I can understand, in the past, the police weren't necessarily very good at receiving reports of rape, that they didn't believe the victims. And so to have plucked up the courage to report something and then to find you're not believed when you report it. But things are changing in that context, aren't they?
Yes and no. So as a result of what you've just said, across the police, the stance that they now take is that they will believe the victim,
mm-hmm.
And they will, you know, investigate the case, of course, and you know, collect all of the evidence, but they will take it, you know, they will, when they talk to the victim, they will make sure that they are clear that they believe the victim. There are still, don't have the stats on this to hand actually, but there are still a vast number of reports which are no crimed, which shouldn't be happening in my view.
And when you say no crimed, what do you mean by that?
That means that the police mark it down as a crime not actually having been committed.
Right.
Which is at odds to the we believe you state. The guy in charge of the Met, mm-hmm. I think, Hogan Rowe, I think his name is, he wants that belief in victims to be removed. That was in, I know that this isn't going out this week, but we're in December, middle of December now, and at the beginning of this week, that was reported that he still is trying to get that belief removed.
What do you mean belief removed?
So he doesn't want police to need to believe the victim, which would take the way police investigate rape allegations back probably about 20 years.
I guess that's why I'm struggling to understand what you're saying, because I'm thinking, well, how can you... So what he's saying, that if, for example, somebody reports a burglary, is he happy to have the police believe that, but doesn't want them to believe?
Yeah, you've got it in a nutshell, Sherry.
Right, okay, that's why I was struggling to understand.
Yeah. You've got it in a nutshell. But thankfully, yeah, he's getting he's got a lot of opposition to that. So I think that's just going to remain his opinion. Unfortunately, he's a very senior person in the police. And so it's concerning that he has that opinion, and that the opinion is, of course, being reported, which means that lots of rape victims will be more disinclined to come forward. And of course, what happened with the Ched Evans result as well is also meaning that lots of rape victims will be more disinclined to come forward, because they might find that their sex lives are put under the microscope in the same way as in that case. So there are some things that are happening which are not good, but then there are some things that are happening which are very good, in the sense that I think that as a kind of a group, I don't know if that's the right word, but we are shouting more, we are not being silenced, and yeah, that people like Madonna, Lady Gaga, Rachel Evans Wood, you know, famous people are saying Me Too, Michelle Thompson in Parliament saying Me Too.
Yes.
It's very, very powerful when people who have a platform can say that, because it brings an awful lot of comfort to hundreds and thousands and millions of people around the world.
And when you get these high profile people saying yes, me too, how does that help people who have been raped themselves? Does it encourage them to disclose? Do the disclosure rates go up? I guess you can't measure it in quite
well
that way. What's your sense of it?
Well, like I said, when I was raped, I felt I hadn't known anyone who'd been raped. I felt very isolated. I felt very alone. And when you start to see that there are others who are famous, who are successful, who are leading their lives, and can be inspiring in so many ways, you start to feel, okay, maybe it's not just me. I'm not so isolated. I don't need to be so fragile all the time, because look what Lady Gaga's doing, despite the fact she still has PTSD. So it's a very comforting to feel part of even just a virtual community, with people. And community is like one of the most important things from recovering from any kind of trauma. If you can talk about what's happened and you feel supported by those around you, you're more likely to make a good recovery, which is why when people are discouraged from talking about it and feeling really isolated and alone, that's not good.
Yeah.
That's why I run a community group on Facebook, which is full of survivors supporting each other. Mm. It's because very often you can't share with your family, especially if it was your family that betrayed you. Mm. Or your family feel let down by your actions. Mm. Bringing shame on the family. You know, there are so many reasons why you won't get the support you need from your immediate circle, that you need to find it in other places and with people who really understand you. And so a survivor community, which, you know, Lady Gaga and Madonna kind of represent in much more sort of macro terms.
Yes.
But then to be able to reach out and get support from complete strangers who also totally understand is incredibly empowering.
Mm. And just thinking about, you know, Madonna and Lady Gaga, for example, I mean, obviously, despite experiences in the past, they've gone on to have huge success. I'm guessing that for some women, to see that you can still go on and have huge success despite your experiences must give them some glimmer of hope if they're still suffering with you know, symptoms of PTSD and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really important to have those role models of, you know, what life can look like after rape. There's another kind of sort of societal idea, I guess, that rape victims are always forever somehow broken. It kind of defines who you are, and that's not really helped by, like, in film and TV when the main, you know, a character is raped, and then, you know, there's a backstory of she was raped, and therefore that has, you know, is the explanation for all her behavior in the rest of the film. But, you know, there's this idea that you will always be somehow a little bit broken is absolutely rubbish. Mm-hmm. There is a way through. And when we start to see other people who've made that way through and are, you know, living a life that they want on their terms, that's incredibly empowering. And that's what we need as survivors is to feel empowered, because mm-hmm. what happened was our autonomy was taken away from us. And so to trust that we have autonomy again is one of those really kind of key basic needs. Yeah. And when we can see other people who most definitely have autonomy over their choices, and what they're doing and how they're doing it, like, you know, Madonna and Lady Gaga are so extreme in the way that they, you know, totally give the finger to the world and do what they want on their terms.
Yeah.
It's an empowering sight for me anyway.
Mm. Emily, I've really enjoyed talking to you today. I think it's such an important topic, and, you know, with those figures that you talked about at the start of the interview, it's something that is going to touch each and every one of us, even if we're not aware of it. So thank you so much for coming and talking today. So for the listeners, do you want to just remind them if they want to get in touch with you, if they want to find out more about the work that you do, where can they go?
If you go to my website, which is reconnected.life, so it's a .life domain name, so www.reconnected.life, and that's where you can find information about how to support a friend. It's where you can find information about whether or not you want to go to the police, and you can find information about how to join my community as well.
Fabulous. Emily, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed talking to you today.
Thank you, Sherry. It's been wonderful. Thank you. Really enjoyed it.
So to everybody else who's listening, if you want to find out more about the other interviews coming up, then if you visit theconfidentmother.co.uk and go to the conference tab, all the details are there. Thank you for listening to me today, and talk to you next time.